I think that should just be the theme of the show today. Anything goes. Just say what you want. Do what you just, you know, any topic. Which is anything goes. That's
absolutely
anything goes. That's terrific. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. It is Thursday, the 15th. Remember when this day used to mean something? April 15th was tax day. Well, not this year, but we'll figure that out at some point. But right now, it's just April 15th, and that's good enough. It's a rainy Thursday, snow on the way, as Ray just indicated. So we shake our heads at that development this morning. I mean, not to put you on the spot here, Alan, but you seem to be the one who's really going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, 3 to 6 inches, and yeah. I don't like it. I don't like it one bit.
That's a lot.
I just got back from the media project, a terrific crew today, and Rex Smith is really good at directing that program. That's all I got to say about that.
All right, excellent.
As far as Gump would say, that's all I'm going to say about that.
Anything goes. All right, we're going to welcome our panel. Alan Shartok is here, and we also welcome the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate at the Berman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, our good friend, Fran Berman. Good morning, Fran. How are you?
I am good. Hey, it's National Geeks on the Radio Day, Joe.
I love it. We need T-shirts next time when we're in person.
We need T-shirts.
I like it. Jim Hendler perhaps falls into that category. He is the Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Jim Hendler, welcome to the program.
Morning, Joe, and I'm proud to have my geek card-carrying card with me. I was very proud. I was featured a few years ago in Geek magazine. I can prove it.
If you're the Geek magazine cover boy, that is like probably the coolest thing ever. That's really awesome.
All right,
it would have been nice
to
be the cover
boy,
but they
picked
Mark Hamill for some reason.
Mark Hamill? Okay. All right, whatever.
But not the centerfold, right?
You know, every time Jim's on, I say he reminds me what I have to do. I have to go out and order my tether bowl.
That's right.
Tether bowl.
How many tether balls do you need?
You need one tether.
You need
a pole.
You replace it every day or every year, I guess.
A pole, a rope, and a sort of volleyball at the end of it.
Yeah.
That's a tether ball.
Tether ball. We are also thrilled to welcome Dr. Carolina Gonzalez to the program this morning. She is brand new, and we couldn't be more thrilled to have her with us. She is Assistant Dean in the College of Education and Human Services at Montclair State University. Carolina, thank you so much for being with us. An honor to have you on our program.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. One little correction, Carolina is how it's pronounced. But thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be here this morning.
All right, Carolina. I always love when I apologize. Yeah, I'm glad. Thank you for telling me.
How are you going to learn?
I know.
Apology. No, I didn't want you to continue calling me Carolina through the whole show.
I know. Because I call Jim Tim all the time, and he gets mad, and it just makes sense. So,
no worries. It happens all the time.
Now,
no worries.
Carolina, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do down there at Montclair State University.
Yes. So I have been in education for about 15 years, a little bit over 15 years, mostly as a higher educational professional, working in colleges and universities and enrollments and opportunity programs. And at Montclair, I am the assistant dean, where I focus a lot on student affairs, student matters, as well as the development of initiatives externally and internally as well.
Excellent. Well, we welcome you to our program, and we look forward to hearing your thoughts on our many issues that we discussed this morning. The same goes
for
our listeners. Really a delight to have you on the program. We welcome our listeners as well, panel at WAMC.org, if you'd like to be part of the fun. panel at WAMC.org. And all you have to do is write to us, keep your letters brief and to the point, and spell things correctly, and we'll be all good. Let's get to the rundown for today. A lot to talk about. Just a reminder, too, at 10:30 this morning, Dr. Jim Fagan is going to be on the program with us. He is a pediatric immunologist, and he'll be joining Alan and I as we talk about the coronavirus for the last half hour of the panel. And we'll be doing that from 10:30 to 11. So we have a lot to talk about, obviously, with Johnson & Johnson and many other issues. So we will get to that and to your letters on that subject coming up later on, that at 10:30. But from now until then, we have this wonderful group. And we begin with, as I said, there are many stories. But where I would like to start is by this effort, and I just think this, I don't know if this is necessarily like the biggest story of the day, but I think it could be a huge story because we've talked about it for so long and now actual action is taking place. Now, how far that gets is the big question, but I would like to talk about the idea of it. The Democrats are looking to introduce legislation today. This will take place today to expand the Supreme Court of the United States of America. House and Senate Democrats will introduce legislation to expand the number of Supreme Court justices to 13 from 9, drawing more attention to the debate surrounding court reform. The bill, led by your friend, Alan, Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, is the first legislation in recent years designed to add seats to the high court. And its introduction comes as progressive organizations are pushing for court expansion after watching Senate Republicans fill 3 Supreme Court vacancies in 4 years under President Donald Trump. President Joe Biden, however, has said he is, quote, not a fan of the idea, also known as court packing. Instead, the White House announced last week the creation of a bipartisan commission to study reforms to the Supreme Court and produce a report. The high court currently has a 6-3 conservative majority. Alan, as I said at the very beginning, we've discussed this on the periphery for a long time, but now it is at our doorstep. So what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, it ain't going to happen. You can write it down. Because the Republicans, who all live in the land of no, will vote no very quickly. So now you got 50 votes on no. You've got a number of senators who have said, you know, that looked askance at it. You have the leader of the party, Joe Biden, who is saying basically no. But what it does do, I think there is a positive effect from it. What it does do is it puts the court on notice. You better watch yourselves. Because if you don't, if it's all Republicanism all the time and you come down Citizens United and all of those terrible decisions that they've been making, then maybe we'll go back to it. But my bet is that, you know, that's not going to happen.
Carolina, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was a constant question that obviously we know President Biden was posed with during his campaign trail and tried to avoid it and semi not answer it, quite honestly. And I think only when he gave a I'm not a fan of it response was when the media backed off. I think that the commission is a good indication of him trying to explore what possibilities are there. Although, like Alan mentioned, I don't think it will happen. I do think, though, that the Democrats' introduction of this bill speaks loudly and says or states that they don't want to wait for a commission to conduct its analysis or to come with recommendations, and they want to try and change things sooner if they can, and at least just put people on notice, as Alan mentioned as well.
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I think this is pretty interesting. Sadly, I think Alan's right that it probably, you know, as a bill isn't going to work. But Here's some stuff that I learned when I was kind of poking around looking at this. This is not a new idea. The Federal Judiciary Act of 1789 kicked it all off with six justices. So originally we had six justices. That changed like six times between then and now. You know, we had six, then we had five, then we had seven, then we had nine. You know, and it's kind of jumped around for various purposes, sometimes political, for sure. So, you know, it's sort of interesting that that's just not a hard and fast number. I do think that if it's a non-starter, which, you know, it probably is, this commission will be a really interesting thing. So so Biden wants this commission to study, you know, Supreme Court reform instead. And, you know, there's other things that could be done. For example, there's no age limit on Supreme Court justices. But imagine that put some sort of limitation on, you know, who could serve for how long and when. So they're, you know, not a lawyer, to be sure. But there's probably some interesting things to be explored. And, you know, I do think it's kind of an interesting direction.
Jim Handler.
Yeah, you know, I think there's, I too agree with Alan that it's not likely to pass anytime soon, but I think it also has another purpose because it sends a message to this court. Recently, there have been some fairly minor but impactful decisions by the current court, very conservative decisions, and they're not the big issues that are looming, but we can see Roe versus Wade coming, we can see some other things, and there's a very strong move from the right wing to ask the court not just to make narrow rulings in those, but very large rulings. So, for example, in the abortion case, Roe versus Wade, the talk up until recently has been, will they overturn it? Meaning the states will get to make their own decisions. Now it looks like there's going to be a push to actually get them to outlaw it, using some weird reading of the 14th Amendment and things like that. And I think that Congress is really sending a message with this that says, if you go too far, we can change this.
Exactly. Exactly. They put them on notice and they say, you do this. And I think that they're going to be watching themselves. And I think that's an effective strategy, don't you, Jim?
You know, there's not a lot of other strategies to use, Alan. I think so. Absolutely. There's been a move to do that, to put this into legislation for a while now. I think the fact that there were these recent rulings, which is almost immediately followed by this being put on the docket, really makes it a very clear message.
And the context, of course, is the denial of Obama being allowed to put his attorney general, then a candidate for the court, on the court. So I think the American people got the idea that Trump, in addition to lying and lying and lying, was also a guy who did some terrible things, and one of them was with the court.
Alan, there's been some pressure that I heard on Breyer to retire before the midterms. What do you think about that?
I love vanilla ice cream. No.
With sprinkles?
There are a lot of people. You'd have to be older to get that. Because I remember when Uncle Joe came over with cherry vanilla and he says, this is a new flavor. That's how old. So I can just say, you're right. I think... that the pressure will be great, and we'll see whether or not it achieves the results. I think Roberts is the most interesting guy on the court now, because more and more he's siding with the progressives or the liberals on the court, and that is fascinating to me because he knows the truth. He's doing what judges are supposed to do, the cult of the robe. You put on the robe, and you can't be fired, and that's why we say you can't be fired.
We're going to
– But I do
– We got to pause there.
Okay, sure, go ahead.
We have to go to a break. We will do that. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the panel this morning. Alan Sharta, Carolina Gonzalez, Jim Hendler, and Fran Berman. We go, let's see, we have letters on this, and I'd like to go to those, and then we will talk more. Alan thinks this legislation puts pressure on the court. He also thinks Robert is becoming more liberal. Alan, what's really happening? The Roberts Court has an 80-0 record in favor of corporate interests, according to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse.
It's not good. And when it comes to things like, the letter writer is quite right, when it comes to things like religion, anything that says God trumps everything else. So, and there was no pun intended there, but,
right.
You know, that that if it's a school has to do something or can't do something, or you can't protect people's lives by telling them they can't gather if it has a religious significance, it's been rather disturbing. So the point is well taken. And yet on some of these, like the stealing of the election, Roberts was where he should be.
I just want to go back to what Fran brought up, because I think it's an interesting point about Justice Breyer. There is pressure on him to resign, so you get a younger member of the court who can be on for much longer. Jim, what do you make of that?
I think there's a lot to be said for that. On the other hand, we also know that the justices don't always go along with these things. I mean, you know, there was a lot of talk at various times about Ruth Bader Ginsburg stepping down so that Obama could get the replacement. Now, as it worked out with that Senate, who knows what would have happened. But I think, you know, it's now a favorable time for the Democrats if he did. On the other hand, it's not going to materially change the court right now. The midterms, again, is the big question mark in all of this.
By the way, Jim, absolutely. I don't know what you did, but you sound, I can hear you now. You sound great.
I changed from my new earbuds, which turn out not to be very good, to my old microphone, which is working just fine. And
you,
I don't know why I stopped.
You sound fantastic. So that's good. We can hear you now. I was worried.
Okay. I don't remember, Jim, but were you the guy that it was broadcasting from the men's room at one point? Wasn't there
No, that was
I don't want to out him any more than already has been done, but that was Bob Griffin. And I think he's vaguely proud of it, so I don't mind telling him. Carolina, what do you make of Breyer and the idea of the retirement?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the issues that is always brought up by conservatives with regards to the reforming of the courts. And so it's almost as though if you start with one thing, then where does the reform end? I know that there was also conversation regarding, you know, instead of it being a lifetime appointment, putting limits to that as well. And so I think it's a slippery slope that we understand why people who are traditionalists and are seeking to not disrupt the current makeup of the court and why is this an issue that is very, very delicate.
Yeah. Let's go to more letters, and we welcome yours, panel at wamc.org. We could have legitimate arguments as to whether the justices of the Supreme Court, writes Robert, carry out their duties objectively and non-politically, but there is no argument as to the politically fueled nomination confirmation process. That's where all the reforms should be focused. There is no way to go about court packing without having it appear totally political from half the country. All right. We go to Stephen, who says, out of curiosity, the Fran mentioned the number of Supreme Court justices having been changed in the past. Would there be any possibility to lower the current number of justices, the criteria being removing a number of the most recent appointees?
Boy, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I would imagine that the commission, you know, would look at would explore all of these things, you know, the political character of the process. I mean, my ideal commission anyway, the political character of the process, how long justices, you know, are on the court, the number of justices, and in some sense, you know, one would want to correlate that with the amount of workload they have, because it's a really different country than it was in the past. But I don't know. I mean, I think if you want to reduce the number of justices, then you get in this crazy, probably super messy argument about who do you kick off.
Right.
And also,
that's how, you know, you could kick off the oldest ones. You could kick off the last ones.
Last hired, first fired.
That like vanilla ice cream. I don't know.
That's right. With sprinkles. Yes.
With sprinkles, yeah.
David writes and says, most of the panel being liberals to one degree or another, you're upset by having a conservative Supreme Court. But in the spirit of providing perspective or looking at the big picture, we should bear in mind that half the country, more or less, is okay with conservative justices. Also, we got this from Jen, I love the idea of age limits or term limits for the Supreme Court. I'm not a fan of the death watch for new seats. I also think that there is an addition to the court. It should be a single seat, which would force the justices on a 50-50 court to shift to make their decisions relevant. If they have a tie, the lower court ruling should stand. Also, this from David, since John Roberts assumed the role of Chief Justice in 2005, the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of religious claimants 81% of the time. With the addition of Kavanaugh and the Comey Barrett, there are six Catholics on the court. There is now a case in the court, Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia, where Catholic Social Services wants to use their religious beliefs to deny same-sex couples from adopting children. Is justice being served when six justices around the same team as the plaintiffs? But as you indicated, Alan, that's not always the case, that those all six aren't always on the same team.
Well, look, first of all, on Roberts, I don't want to become defensive of Roberts, and I'm not the head of his, you know, his team. Nevertheless, I have to say they could have done something worse. Can you imagine Clarence Thomas as the Chief Justice or Alito or one of those guys? So everything is comparative in life. So I don't know. What was the question again?
And now at this very moment, I of course don't remember. No, the the question was, does anyone remember what the question was?
Well, we can move on.
Okay.
It'll come back to us.
All right.
Joe, one of the previous letters, though, mentioned term limits. And I think that's an interesting idea that I hope the commission will look at, because the whole idea of giving life appointments to the justices was to remove the politicalization of serving right. to a president. And supposedly would cause both sides to say, hey, we have to find somebody who's going to be neutral because this could be forever. The idea that you could take term limits, say 15 years, 13 years, pick your favorite, which would go beyond a current presidency by definition, that could be a way of achieving more change on the court in a more balanced way without getting into the kind of tit for tat, you know, we're going to make it bigger, we're going to make it smaller, that could just go on forever.
Yeah. Well, you make a lot of good points. Here in Massachusetts, of course, you got to get off at a particular time. And I think that has worked out quite well. The problem is you're playing with the dice at the time. So, pardon me, you roll the dice at the wrong time. And somebody who just happens to be sitting there gets what we now know as a political appointment.
So the question, and I'm bad on memory on command, but given a moment, what we were talking about was the letter writer was talking about the case of in Philadelphia and about same-sex couples adopting and saying that is it fair when you have six members on the same team? And I was pointing out to your point earlier, Alan, that you know, those six members always aren't on the same team, that there is division within those ranks.
Yeah. Well, You know, some of them are more progressive than others. Some of them are crazier than others. I mean, you know, the present court is really inviting some kind of change that this commission may bring based on the fact that their behavior has been bad. Political behavior has been bad. Legal behavior.
Let's see. We got this last question before break. You said anything goes. My wife calls them Jimmy's, not sprinkles. Any thoughts?
I always hated that name.
That's just wrong.
Is that a, that's a regional. That's, isn't that a regional?
I think very so.
Yes. Yeah, there are lots of regional things like soda. I'm going for a soda.
And pop.
Or right? I'm going for a pop. Now, in other places, pop means something else. So the, each of these words have different definitions depending where in the country you are, right?
Yeah.
We always thought it was fun to go for a cabinet in Rhode Island.
What's that?
A cabinet?
A cabinet, what we would call a milkshake, typically.
Uh-huh. Oh, come on. That's
really? Look it up.
Oh, you're making me hungry for ice cream. Oh, my God.
The term, the name Jimmy's, believe to have been first documented in 1930 by the Just Born Candy Company of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. They claim to have invented Jimmy's and named them after an employee whose name was Jimmy.
That's just wrong.
All right. So with that important information out to the world, we pause, we take a break, and we'll come back. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Carolina Gonzalez, Jim Handler, and Fran Berman join us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so let's go to other stories here that we will follow this morning, and then we'll go back to letters as well. We go to this story this morning, which of course has to do with what happened in Minnesota and what is happening in Minnesota, another night of unrest. So the big change from when we last talked about this yesterday is that the Minnesota officer who killed Daunte Wright was charged with manslaughter. We reported yesterday that she had resigned, Kimberly Potter resigned, as did the police chief. Yesterday, the Minnesota police officer who fatally shot Daunte Wright, a 20-year-old black man, after appearing to mistake her handgun for her taser, was arrested on Wednesday and charged with second-degree manslaughter following three nights of protests over the killing. The arrest of the officer, who is white, came a day after she resigned from the Brooklyn Center Police Department, as did the Minneapolis suburbs police chief. Hundreds of people have faced off with the police in Brooklyn Center each night since Mr. Wright's death on Sunday, demanding that the former officer be charged, even as the region is on edge amid the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis officer charged with murdering George Floyd last May. Peter Orpett, the top prosecutor in Washington County, said that Ms. Potter had been taken to jail and was awaiting a first court appearance. Under Minnesota statutes, second-degree manslaughter can apply in cases where someone has created, quote, unreasonable risk and kills another person through negligence. The maximum punishment for conviction is 10 years in prison. Alan.
Well, look, I said it yesterday, and I'm going to say it again today. We would not tolerate making, quote, a mistake. The chief is gone because he said, well, you know, she just made a mistake. Well, a guy is dead because of that mistake. We also know all the other stuff about reaching down and thinking you have a gun and a taser and finding out that you have a gun. No, that's not acceptable. I mean, I have no idea what kind of an individual she is. But I do know that the message now goes forth. You can't make mistakes. You probably shouldn't be carrying them in any way. I worked for a police commissioner at one point in New York, and I was working on a writing project with him, and I said, have you ever drawn your gun? Now think about this, folks. He said in his entire career, coming up from patrolman all the way to the top, he had never taken his gun out of his holster. So there are many policemen who never do. And I think that that's pretty important. Nevertheless, I think the message is now out there.
Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, this story is sad all the way around, because on one hand, we have this police officer who claims to have been confused and to have been believed of using her taser. But she was a veteran, right? As Alan mentioned, she's a 26-year veteran and who was actually training another officer during this stop. When you see the body cam video, we see her holding a gun. So if we are seeing the body cam video with her holding the gun, it's hard to understand why she didn't notice that she was holding a gun instead of a taser. And of course, we weren't there, and we know that police officers have to make difficult decisions and are in high pressure situations. But in all honesty, police officers who do not follow protocol and or abuse their power really need to be held accountable. This is also another example of why a deep review and investigation of these types of cases needs to happen by leaders beyond respective police departments or local governments, and so that there could actually be reform and retraining and restructuring of funding and even reporting lines. So, I mean, at the end of the day, we know that there's implicit bias when it comes to all of this. That's part of these decisions, and that this is all centered also around systemic racial injustice. So at the end of the day, the Black community is exhausted of repeatedly bringing this to the forefront, only to have these cases happen over and over again. And Daunte Wright should be alive today. And because of her quote-unquote mistake, he's not.
Jim Handler.
Yeah, you know, I agree with a lot of that. You know, I think somebody earlier on the show in the past couple of days asked the question that I keep asking, which is, why would she even be pulling the taser, that given the situation showed up? But I've been noticing something else that hasn't made the big news headlines. But you look at the police union's responses. They're critiquing the mayor. They're defending this officer. They are saying, you know, this was all because the person didn't comply, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the power in the police unions, the, you know, individual policemen are actually usually, without identifying by name, are saying, you know, this was terrible. But you have the union that's defending them, you know, these people. We've had the same thing, a lot of the stuff on qualified immunity, a lot of the things with hiding officers' records, all of that's negotiated by the unions. And we really have this very powerful block who really, you know, are pushing for absolute power, you know, control. And there has to be a rebalancing at some point.
So how do you rebalance?
Well, I think some of it is very much the kind of thing you can see in the Albany suggestions for reform. So some of it is better, significantly more training and de-escalation. So in a lot of countries overseas, particularly Britain, there's a tremendous amount of training that goes into making sure that you won't have to pull that taser or that gun. As they don't even carry guns unless they get special authorization in general. If you look at some of the things for treating people with drug addiction, treating people with mental health issues, all of those things, again, we need people who are trained in that, specialists who could be called in the way we would call someone. You know, we call in a military SWAT unit when we have one kind of thing going on, but we don't have a different group to call in when it when what's really needed is something very different. So in a lot of these shootings, so again, there's a lot that can be done. It's not eliminating the police. It's a lot of training, a lot of rethinking what the role is, a lot of reevaluating what the police are doing now versus what they were doing 20 years ago, and working out, you know, what's a rational system.
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Jim and Carolina have said. It's just tragic all around, you know, assuming that she didn't intend to shoot him. You know, there's just no winners in this. And I agree with Alan that, you know, you have to be accountable, and it's completely egregious to kill someone. I mean, you don't get to do that. On the other hand, we live in an imperfect world, and you can't have any job that requires you to be perfect. And so the question is, you know, how do you deal with reality? And I think one of the things Jim said, which is that, you know, we have made police sort of general purpose fixers for things. You know, they have to fix mental health issues. They have to fix drug issues. They have to fix domestic abuse issues. They have to, you know, enforce the law on the roads. And I agree with Jim that I think taking the jobs for which we need specialists, whether it's defusing a bomb or, you know, or dealing with addiction, I think will help. I think the process also, you know, as people are looking at, needs to be looked at. If you have a routine traffic arrest, why do you even have your gun with you? You know, why do you need a gun? You know, will a taser not do? And so, you know, that will, you know, those kinds of changes in process, if it makes sense, you know, might make the situation a little safer. But no matter what we put in the system to make it safer, there's always going to be errors somewhere along the line, and then we have to figure out what to do about it. And of course, in this environment, where all of us, you know, are very highly sensitized to the racial issues, to the issues of misbehavior, to all of that kind of stuff. It's not helpful. If I can just say one more thing, there's just one contrast for me between this case, which just seems tragic from beginning to end, and the trial of Derek Chauvin, where there was clear intentionality there. And now there's, you know, this argument about, you know, did he die from did George Floyd die from the officer's actions, or, you know, was there something else there? And, you know, I've just been sort of watching that with some sense of misbelief. You know, if somebody blows up a bridge and, you know, you can say, was it a weaker bridge? Was it a stronger bridge? Was it an ugly bridge? But the fact is that person's action of blowing up the bridge made the bridge go away. And you know, why we're talking about all of these other things, which are sort of relevant to George Floyd, maybe as a person, but not necessarily to how he died. I don't know. It kind of mystifies me.
We're going to pause there. We have much more to discuss, and we will do so. We welcome your letters, as always. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. A reminder coming up at 10:30 this morning, pediatric immunologist Dr. Jim Fagan will join us. We'll be talking about the coronavirus, of course, spending a good deal of the time talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as well as other issues, and we'll welcome your letters during that segment as well. We'll have our final half hour with this wonderful panel when we return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It's 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. We're going to go to 10:30 this morning with this wonderful group. And then at 10, just after the 10:30 BBC News, we will be joined by Dr. Jim Fagan, who is a pediatric immunologist, and we'll be talking about COVID and vaccines and all of that good stuff. Not good. You know what I mean? All right. Let's go back to some news stories here and some things that I would like to talk about in our last segment, we were just talking about the manslaughter charge, which of course brings us to the Derek Chauvin trial, which, as the prosecution has wrapped up their case and the defense is expected to start wrapping up their case fairly soon. Yesterday, a prominent forensic pathologist testified for Derek Chauvin's defense Wednesday that George Floyd died of, quote, sudden cardiac arrhythmia because of existing heart disease and illicit drug use, contradicting prosecution experts who said Floyd succumbed to a lack of oxygen while pinned to the ground under the officer's knee. David Fowler, a former chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland, said he would not have categorized Floyd's death a homicide, as an autopsy declared, saying there were too many conflicting factors to accurately determine the manner of death. He also suggested Floyd's exposure to exhaust from a nearby police squad car may have contributed to his death, though he later admitted during cross-examination from the prosecution that he wasn't even sure the vehicle was running. Fowler cited a tumor in Floyd's lower abdomen that he said could have added to his existing high blood pressure and caused a sudden surge of adrenaline to his compromised heart. Although, again, in cross-examination, he said that there was no, that his cause of death would be labeled as undetermined. So, with that, that is what the defense is working on at the moment. Alan.
Well, I'm not going to say much because we got such a distinguished panel here, but I do want to say that, you know, I know an awful lot of physicians who make, when in their, during their retirement, they make their money by going around and testifying at trials. And you better know that they are recruited because of what they are going to say. Some people have an idea of what they are going to say, so you can basically bring somebody in. Now, I watched that Fowler testimony, and I really thought the guy was off the wall. And under skillful questioning from the prosecutorial people, he basically backed off on almost everything he had. What he's trying to do is give them anything that they can hang their hat on and find reason for some juror to vote not guilty.
Right. One thing to note, as many trial watchers have noted, is that in this case, there were so many prosecution witnesses and medical testimony on various states of this, and in the defense, it's just basically this one guy. So that also is something that
he wasn't that good.
What
that was the other thing.
And
Jim, go ahead.
And it might be worth noting that I don't know if it's come out in the trial. It was certainly in some of the coverage in the Washington Post and other places. So Fowler is himself currently being sued for ruling a very similar case to be an accident rather than a homicide. So there was a Maryland case where he was when he was the medical examiner in Maryland, a case where a police officer pinned down a black suspect and he eventually died. Very similar case. He ruled that an accident, and you know that the police, you know, so that meant the policeman was off the hook unless something major happened. And the family of that victim are now suing him. Now that doesn't, you know, again, this is courts. He can be sued. Who knows? But you know, the things he's saying in this case are the same defense he's using for himself in another case.
But the jurors aren't allowed to know that about the other case.
I think the jurors are not allowed to know that.
No, they're not.
Whether,
I know. I mean, yeah. unless the news media is deceiving me.
Okay.
We don't do that.
I didn't know if they were supposed to.
Never. Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, like Alan, I was troubled and I was confused by his testimony. I watched it also, and I really couldn't wrap my head around as to why this person was called as an expert as an expert. I felt like he discredited himself because he brought up theories about George Floyd's, the cause of George Floyd's death that weren't even introduced at all previously. I mean, the carbon monoxide and when the the carbon monoxide theory, and then when the prosecution really focused on that and asked him, have you seen any evidence? He tried to say, he said no and tried to explain why. And the prosecution did such a really great job by stopping him and saying, no, it's a yes or a no. Right. And so, I mean, I think that when I came away from that thinking, oh, they're essentially trying to introduce some sort of confusion or any, you know, any kind of reason for the jury to doubt the possibility of Derek Chauvin's contribution to or Derek Chauvin's responsibility and role in killing George Floyd. But quite honestly, I mean, they need only one juror to disagree to convict. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what they're going with. I think the black community expects Derek Chauvin to be convicted, but I can't say that it will be a surprise if he's not, you know, based on the historical the history of the justice system continuously failing communities of color by not holding guilty police officers accountable. Though in this case, it seems like it's very clear cut and very obvious.
You know, I got a little bit of a different take, Carolina. You're really absolutely right. However, my difference take is that what the defense is looking for is somebody who comes in wanting not to convict. In other words, it's not as if, you know, they're looking at the information and they decide, okay, but they're looking for that person who is likely to say, I don't want to convict this police person because I don't believe in convicting police people. Do you all understand the differential on that?
I mean, yeah.
To me, that's the difference.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would just mention quickly that I think that the prosecution's, I don't remember his exact name, but essentially Derek Chauvin's supervisor, putting him on the stand and him essentially blessing the charges against Chauvin and saying, this is not how we do our work. This does not represent our training. It was, I think, a very strategic move because it sent the message to the jury that, you know, this is not the police department is not on trial. Derek Chauvin is on trial. You know, so if you want to convict him because you believe that he's guilty, then this is not against, you will not be convicting the police department. You will be convicting him.
Mm. Fran.
Well, the other thing they seem to be putting on trial is the autopsy. So the autopsy was done with someone who was actually with the body and actually could, on direct data, on data they were dealing with on his body, figure out what they thought the cause of death was. And they ruled that it was homicide. And they ruled that it was homicide on account of the pressure that had been put on his neck that forced him not to breathe and his heart stopped. And so all of this stuff about, you know, what shape was he in? Was he a good guy or not? You know, is not so relevant because that apparently, you know, that was my bridge analogy. It doesn't matter whether it was a weaker bridge or a strong bridge. It's you know, the bomb that blew it up. It appears from the autopsy that that was the cause of death. So all of this stuff trying to discredit basically the autopsy just seems really odd to me. And so, you know, as I listened to this trial, you know, not so familiar with legal proceedings myself, so it just seems like a lot of gamesmanship and gamesmanship in a really tragic way. So, yeah.
All right. In our, let's see, we got about 12 minutes left. What did you say at the beginning of the show that this was the geek show? Is that what you called it?
It's not the geek show.
What did you say?
It hasn't been the Geek Show. No, so it's National Geek Day.
Oh, it's National Geek Day. So let's get to that and those stories. We have two interesting ones that I'm interested in what our panel thinks on this. So one story is the fact that, and you may remember the brouhaha about this, but the FBI wanted to unlock the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone, and what it ultimately ended up doing is going to an Australian firm. And they unlocked the phone at the center of this legal battle between the FBI and Apple. Now Apple is suing the company co-founded by one of the hackers behind the unlock. So, Fran, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Jim on this. How big a deal is this lawsuit, and what will it ultimately decide? Or what could it ultimately decide?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the lawsuit against the company of one of the guys that originally was able to unlock the smartphone, and he did that just to get people up to speed. Apple had put, and Jim should definitely join me on this. Apple had put a process in place by which this information was private, and for the government to ask them to undo that process, to actually figure out how to unlock their own iPhone, is not something that that they knew how to do at the time. And if they did do it, it would provide a backdoor. So the government was starting to grapple with Apple about whether they could demand that or not. And this Australian firm came and found an exploit. And the way these exploits often work is there's a vulnerability somewhere, and then it leads you to another vulnerability somewhere else, and then it leads you to another vulnerability somewhere else. And in this case, you were allowed to unlock the iPhone and get around the process that Apple had put in place, that after 10 tries, you were kind of out.
Right.
And so this guy started his own company, one of the guys from the Australian firm, and now Apple is suing this company to say that, you know, trying to like hack around the iPhone is somehow okay. This is crazy stuff, and cybersecurity in our society is not transparent enough, is done too much by the wrong people, is not governed by any kinds of federal rules. So you see these sort of things, whereas Apple tried to hire this guy, and then when they couldn't, they're trying to sue him. So it kind of gives you the sense about the crazy space in which all of this tech is happening. I don't know, Jim, feel free to jump in there.
Yes, Jim.
Yeah, so Fran, I thought, you know, that's perfect, as I expect from you always, but let me put a little larger context around it. So this is the latest little piece in a very long-running controversy over whether the government has the right to look at this kind of information and whether the technology companies have to provide a means. And the place where it mostly comes out is this stuff called encryption. So the information on your phone is locked to those numbers you put in at the beginning, or to your face or your fingerprint, whichever one you're using. And nobody else can see the information on the phone unless they have that. The government wants companies that provide these kind of communications to always allow a way that it can be unscrambled so that the government could subpoena it and get the information. The technology and security communities oppose this almost uniformly. I mean, as much as any group of scientists ever all agree on something. The analogy that's often used is it's like having your front door key hidden under your doormat, right? Yes, that makes it so the person you ask to come feed your cats can get in. But it also means that anyone else who knows where keys are hidden is going to be able to come into your house. So it's rather than being a way to increase your security, it's a way to impact your security, hurt your security. So there's a lot of controversy around this. There was an effort by the Trump administration to put laws in place to demand that this be done. It didn't happen. But this is a controversy, you know, it's going to be a long-running controversy. And, you know, it's one of those things we geeks are keeping a close eye on. I was actually signed on to an amicus brief related to some of this. So it, you know, the courts are really being asked to grapple with this, and people were very scared that that case was going to be the one that would go and get a definitive ruling. It ended up not happening. And so this is the latest attempt people are making to get some legislation in place that says you cannot, you know, demand that we make our phones insecure for you.
Wait. I gotta go to the front door and move something under my mask.
And what Jim's talking about, Alan, is this backdoor business. So yeah. If you create a backdoor in this software, which basically means there's some way for someone in the know, so the government, to get in and read this, and, you know, ostensibly in good cases, they've got a criminal, they're trying to figure out, you know, something about them or an alleged criminal. It actually makes this vulnerable to everyone because, you know, hackers, you know, are from all over the world. They can hack any surface you want, which is the internet. They can hack the device. They can hack the algorithm. They can, you know,
A-bombs.
Yeah, they can go through anything.
12-year-olds.
So if you put in a back door, a hacker can find it. And so the question is, you know, this is what Jim's point is about. It really doesn't make it more safe. It makes it less safe.
Let's go to one other story here while we're talking about lawsuits and tech, and that is from the Washington Post. A wrongfully arrested man is suing the Detroit Police Department over false facial recognition matches. The case could fuel criticism of police investigators' use of controversial technology that has been shown to perform worse on people of color. So I would like to Jim or Fran, who wants the lead on this? And then I want to go to Carolina as well.
I'll just jump in. This is, I think, an even more, the other one is pretty important. And this one I think is even more important. If you think about it, your face provides a face print. And your face is everywhere. Your face is on, you know, Facebook. Your face is on your driver's license. Right. Your face is everywhere. And these companies are collected tremendous databases. And I'm talking billions of images of people's faces. And then they're using them sometimes for good, for, you know, trying to figure out who criminals are, and sometimes not. But these facial algorithms, facial recognition algorithms should not be used on their own. In this case, it led to a false arrest. And now this guy is suing because he was arrested based on very bad detective work and partial information. But a really important thing to know is that the National Institute of Standards and Technology actually tested over 100 of these facial recognition algorithms. And most of them are bad on people of color. Most of them do not do a good job in trying to distinguish the faces and match them with correct images, correct contact information for people of color. So not only is this a powerful and really imperfect tool, but it's a tool that's creating bias.
And let me add to that. It's not just, you know, I mean, there are gender issues with this. There are racial and cultural issues with this. There's some other things going on too. So for example, the lighting conditions where something occurs. There's issues to do with how the camera, how digital cameras record these things. I'm the chairman of the U.S. Technology Policy Committee of a group called the Association of Computing Machinery, which represents about 100,000 members. Wow. So it's the largest computer science and related.
Call me in.
Professional society.
Yeah, sounds like a big deal.
And we came out with a statement calling on governments to put a moratorium on the use of face rec technology precisely for these reasons. We simply don't have a good way of telling how well they work. Even those NIST benchmarks, which are the best we have, once people start trying to just perform well on those, we lose track of how well they perform in practice out on the real streets and things like that. So think about the difference between your picture being posted on Facebook with a big smile at a party, and then, you know, somebody seeing somebody walking on a rainy night in the dark from a camera in a moving police car and being arrested because they think you're the same person. That's the kind of technologies we're talking about. And with a lot of the AI technologies, really understanding how well they work is difficult. And this is one where it really is impacting people's rights without us really fully understanding the technology.
Carolina, I want to get your perspective. Unfortunately, we only have about a minute, but what do you think?
Yeah, just real quickly. I first came across, you know, the issues of our artificial intelligence technologies and a while ago. And remember from a presentation how they described how they're largely developed by white men and are largely tested on white people. And so obviously, as we've talked about, it disadvantages people of color because they're racially biased to begin with. I also know that they use the police departments use these technologies in tandem with mugshot databases. And if, you know, us knowing that black people are more likely to be arrested than white people for minor crimes, it really exacerbates or continues the cycle of criminalizing black people when we use these two technologies that may not truly represent, accurate conclusions on a potential suspect.
Carolina, thank you so much for being a part of our program this morning. I so appreciate you joining us, and I look forward to our next go-around. Group, thank you very much. We'll be back with Dr. Fagan right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our discussion this morning. We are very pleased for this segment until top of the hour this morning to welcome Dr. Jim Fagan, a pediatric immunologist who has been with us for many months as we've worked our way through this global pandemic, and use him as our expert on what is happening in the world of medicine and COVID and coronavirus. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the program, Dr. Fagan. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me back, Joe.
So I know Alan's got questions for you. I've got questions for you. I guess the place to start, though, is how much this Johnson & Johnson pause screws things up.
Well, it does obviously cause some problems. But, you know, I think it's very important that the CDC and the FDA exercise an abundance of caution when dealing with a novel vaccine. I think, you know, we always have to remember that the learning curve in medicine has no endpoint. And, you know, that being said, if you look at, you know, the incidence of, you know, what they're dealing with, the concern obviously is this blood clotting that occurred. There were six women who developed this cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which in and of itself is extremely rare. I think the incidence of that is, you know, 5 cases per million people per year. So there were 6 women who developed this condition. And what's even more concerning is the fact that not only did they develop these blood clots in the brain, but all 6 women also had an associated what we call thrombocytopenia, which means that their platelet count was very, very low. And so what we need to do is understand, you know, what is that association? That's extremely rare to have low blood platelets and thrombosis and clotting. Usually the blood clots are caused by the platelets that clump. You're more likely to have a blood clot if your platelet count is high rather than low. And so I think that this obviously needs to be very carefully investigated to see if, in fact, this is related to the vaccine. It may not be related to the vaccine at all. I mean, again, there are 6 women. If you look at the demographics, all 6 women were white. Only one was taking hormonal contraceptive. The reason I bring that up is that that can be that taking hormonal contraceptives can be associated with an increase in clotting. And all six women, as I said, had this low platelet count. And it's exceptionally rare, especially in healthy young individuals. And so there's some concern there. What is the impact of temporarily pausing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? Well, it's fairly large. I mean, especially in certain populations. It's great that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is, it's a one-shot vaccine. It makes it much easier to administer to, certain populations, people who would find it difficult to return for the second shot. So I think it's a real blow now. I mean, a pause of a couple of weeks, I don't think is going to set us back that much. But certainly it's something that I wouldn't take lightly.
Alan?
Well, when you say you wouldn't take it lightly, fortunately, I know you and I know your family. Would you tell your family, Jim Fagan, to stay away from it if they came to you and said, "Pop, want to take the Johnson & Johnson? It's easier to get to. They can give it to me." Intuitively, and this is what we call an honesty question, obviously.
Yeah.
What would you do?
The answer is yes. I would say they should take it, and the reason I say that is because first of all, remember, there were 7.5 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that have already been administered.
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine
has proven to be very, very effective in preventing moderate to severe disease, death, and hospitalization and death. So we know that. We also know, Alan, that the incidence of clots and strokes is much higher with the COVID-19 disease than it is with any of the vaccines, including the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So, if I had my choice right now, you could take Moderna, Pfizer, or Johnson & Johnson, obviously I would say, well, take Moderna, Johnson, or Pfizer. But if the choice was you can get vaccinated now or you might have to wait, we're not sure exactly when you would be able to get vaccinated with Moderna or Pfizer, but you can get vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson right now, to someone who is otherwise healthy, I would say take the vaccine.
So I have and the next question, and it's only because, even though I had my share of statistics in college and graduate school. Okay, so now you look at that same 6 million population. Couldn't you pick out some other things that people had, like heart attacks or, numbers of people? What can we expect the next big blow to be?
Well, but that's an excellent point, Alan, and that's why they have to really look at this very, very carefully to determine, was this truly related to the vaccine or was this just a coincidental finding? Again, if 5 out of every million people per year develop cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, then having 6 women develop it is not that unusual. Now, what makes it unusual is, these were 6 young women. They were between the ages of 18 and 48, so they were young. I don't know their medical histories, but what I understand is that they were fairly healthy. The thing that bothers me the most is what I mentioned before, is thrombocytopenia, the fact that they all had low platelets. Now, that would suggest the possibility that maybe this is an immune response to the vaccine, where they're developing, because of the vaccine, for some reason that we don't understand, antibodies or some sort of immune response against platelets, which would result in the thrombocytopenia, the low platelet count, and how that sort of ties in with the cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, I don't know. And the other thing is, having blood clots in the brain like that is fairly, it's unusual in the cerebral venous sinus area. Blood clots usually form in the legs, and they can travel up and cause pulmonary embolisms and get up into the brain and cause severe, you know, strokes and things like that. But having these clots in that particular area of the brain and also associated with the thrombocytopenia is what concerns me. And so we need to sort of figure this out. But you're right. I mean, if you look at, you know, heart attacks or other, you know, a whole variety of other illnesses, which, you know, we are all prone to, it's very easy to sort of confuse that and associate it with the vaccine. So that's what, you know, they have to look. They have to look at the statistics and say, well, what, you know, is it likely that this is due to the vaccine? And again, the thrombocytopenia, that definitely bothers me. I mean, that you know, six women with, you know, that kind of blood clotting and that condition, and it all occurred within a few weeks after, you know, after the vaccine. And that's why I think they're right to pause Johnson & Johnson and really, you know, take a look at this. I mean, they may discover that these women, what they may discover is that there may be individuals who have a genetic susceptibility to develop a problem, you know, with, you know, this vaccine. And that's a broad concept, because I think that holds true for almost everything. You know, I think that there probably is a genetic susceptibility to adverse reactions to almost everything. You know, even if you look at the COVID-19 infection itself, we know that the vast majority of people with COVID-19, 99% of people who contract COVID-19 have a mild case. But there's those individuals who have moderate to severe disease, end up in the hospital, end up in the ICU, end up on a ventilator, and die. And we know, I mean, you know, to date there's been, you know, over 560,000 people who have died of this infection in the United States. And the question would be, well, how come? What's different about those people than those 99% who get the infection and don't have any problems with it? And I think that's where we're going to find genetic variants. When I say genetic variants, I'm not talking about in the SARS-CoV-2 virus. I'm talking about in us humans, you know, that establish immune responses. And so what I'm saying is that it may turn out that there are people who have genetic mutations that render them susceptible to adverse reactions, both to an infectious disease like COVID-19, and as well as to a vaccination. And it's possible that certain individuals, when they get vaccinated, it stimulates, you know, an immune response, an aberrant immune response that may be responsible for the symptoms that these six women had.
So let me ask, we have to take a break in a minute, but let me ask this question, which I think is, you know, is probably one of the elephants in the room, which is, we had a lot of concern about vaccine hesitancy. So with many people, and yes, this is anecdotal, but even people who respond to polling say one of the reasons they wouldn't get the vaccine is because they feel that it hasn't been tested properly. It came on the market too quickly, not just Johnson & Johnson, but vaccines in general. So what do we do to counter that at this point, even for you as a physician, as Alan noted, asking about, you know, for your family, but for your patients and in general, of how we navigate these choppy waters with people who are reluctant to get vaccinated?
Yeah, I would first say that the clinical trials that Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, that they laid out and that they performed were the same clinical trials that, you know, you would do for any new vaccine. No corners were cut in dealing with this. What made the vaccine production so fast was that they were able to get so many people who were willing to participate in the clinical trials because of the pandemic, that a lot of people signed up, you know, for these clinical trials. There were, I think, 44,000 in the Pfizer trial, 30,000 in the Moderna trial. So, and so they were able, but they weren't cutting corners in terms of what is normally done to develop a new vaccine. And you know, a lot of attention was paid on efficacy, on safety issues, and the results confirmed that these vaccines are very effective and, quite honestly, are very, very, very safe. you know, even given what, you know, this new recent thing with these six women, they're still, look at the 7.5 million people who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine who are now completely immunized against COVID-19 and had no problems with it.
All right, let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with Dr. Jim Fagan. And we welcome your letters. We have time, and we'll do letters when we come back. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan and I are with Dr. Jim Fagan, pediatric immunologist, and we're talking about coronavirus and, of course, many questions from our audience about vaccines and so forth. So we go to Karen. In statistics like this, where six people were found to have developed blood clots, are there always some other people who have had some level of blood clot or low platelet count that was not severe enough to be noticed and so would not have come to the fore as effects to be documented?
The answer is absolutely yes. You know, because we don't generally do blood counts on individuals post-vaccination, and we're certainly not doing imaging studies like MRIs or, you know, CAT scans and things like that that would have to be done. You know, if someone is completely asymptomatic, you know, what, you know, in asymptomatic in terms of not having any headaches or blurred vision or seizures or anything that would obviously suggest the possibility of a cerebral blood clot or stroke, and they're completely asymptomatic, is it? I guess the question is it still possible that some of these people might be experiencing some mild side effects of the vaccine? And the answer is yes. But if they don't develop any symptoms and they're fine, you know, for weeks and months after that, then you know, big deal, I would say. But yeah, you know, again, I think that the answer to that question is yes. It certainly is possible that more than six people, you know, had issues with this vaccine, and we may never know about that. But, you know, as long as they don't develop any significant illness, then I am comfortable with it.
Steve writes, are side effects or a lack thereof an indication of how well the vaccine protects an individual?
Yeah, you know, I always tell patients when they get side effects, and typical side effects from the vaccine are, you know, fever, aches and pains, sore arm, you know, fatigue, those kinds of things. And, you know, I often get calls from, you know, from parents of kids who are experiencing that. And I, you know, tell them, well, that's a good thing because it means that the vaccine is working. It's not a bad thing if they don't have those symptoms. That doesn't mean the vaccine was not working. But reactions that you get to a vaccine, which is sort of a turning on of the immune system, will occur usually, you know, on day one, day two after the vaccine, may last for a couple of days. The problems that these six women had, those problems occurred a couple of weeks, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks, after they received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's a whole different story.
You said kids. You don't. I thought kids couldn't have it yet. But
no, when I'm saying kids, I mean other vaccines like the, you know, the
and the measles. Oh, I see. I got it. Yep,
that.
I got it.
Yeah, the kids are not getting. We kids probably they're working on the 12 to 16 age group, and that probably will be available by the summer.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that. I'm glad Alan brought it up because that, I mean, that's important too. And talk about, you know, what that will allow us, sort of the end game there of bringing kids into the mix of getting vaccinated.
Well, the end game is primarily, you know, school and
right,
and getting everybody back to in-person learning, which I think is critically important. We know that, you know, most kids do fairly well, you know, with COVID-19, although there is this, you know, multi-inflammatory syndrome in children that, you know, it's been reported that we're concerned about. But, you know, the problem with kids, you know, getting COVID-19 is that they transmit it to their parents and their grandparents and adults, some of whom may have conditions that, you know, place them at high risk for COVID-19. And so having kids vaccinated is certainly going to be another, you know, it's going to certainly ease our mind in terms of the transmission of this infection. And I can't wait till we get the kids, you know, 6 to 12 as well, which will probably not be until the end of the year. But, you know, I think that vaccinating kids 12 and older, you know, will certainly be a very good thing to do.
I want to go back real quick to what we were talking about, some of the issues, and you touched on this, so I just want to clarify a little bit more. But are we looking at so I don't really know what I'm talking about here, so bear with me. But my understanding was that one of the reasons that the vaccine, that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that it was different properties, it was a different type of medicine, that Moderna and Pfizer were similar in their makeup, whereas Johnson & Johnson was different. Am I right on
correct.
That so far? Okay.
Absolutely correct.
So now is the same. So my question is the same apply for AstraZeneca? And then if so, what does that tell us about things that veer away from the Pfizer-Moderna model?
Yeah. And no, it's a very good question, Joe, because the AstraZeneca vaccine, by the way, had similar problems with clotting. You know, it wasn't just the Johnson & Johnson. And what's the connection? The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines. The AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine are viral vector vaccines. What a viral vector vaccine means that you take in this case, the RNA of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and you incorporate it into the DNA of the virus. The virus that both Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca use is an adenovirus. The AstraZeneca uses a monkey adenovirus, whereas the Johnson & Johnson uses a human adenovirus. But they're very, very similar. So the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca are very, very similar to each other, just the way that the Moderna and Pfizer are very similar to each other. But the Moderna-Pfizer are very different than the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. So you're absolutely correct. Completely different type of vaccine.
I am absolutely thrilled that on this radio program we got to say monkey adenovirus.
Yeah.
So as far as – let's get away from vaccines just in a second, and we only have about 3 minutes left here. But – as far as where we are in this race and surges and so forth, and concern and opening things up and some pressure in some municipalities around the country for them not to open things up, where do you think we are and what do we need to do? Because as the president, I mean, when the CDC director starts talking about impending doom just a few days ago, I mean, that's scary.
It's very scary. Yeah. You know, so I think that the real problem, Joe, is that, you know, with where we are now with so many Americans being vaccinated, it's incredible. The vaccination program in this country is unbelievable. And we're talking about, you know, 4 million people vaccinated in a day. I mean, it's unheard of. So, but we cannot let our guard down. And I think that is what Dr. Walensky and others are trying to you know, impress people with. Do not let your guard down. And the mask wearing, the social distancing, the hand hygiene is even more important now than it was before, because there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and it would be catastrophic if that light faded away from us, you know, because of a resurgence of this virus. We have to get, you know, everybody vaccinated in this country. That's why the, you know, this thing with Johnson & Johnson, you know, it is a blow. It's a real concern, and hopefully they will resolve this. But I think that what, you know, the CDC officials and the FDA officials are trying to sort of relay to everyone is don't let down your guard now. We know that once you've been fully vaccinated, 2 weeks after you're fully vaccinated, then there are certain things that you no longer have to do. You don't have to wear a mask when you're inside with family members. You can see other families if it's just one family without, you know, wearing a mask. You don't have to, you know, quarantine if you've been exposed to someone with COVID-19 unless you develop some. So there are a lot of, you know, there are major advantages. right now to being vaccinated. But we still have to maintain that vigilance. We still have to, you know, continue the wearing of the mask when you're outside, hand washing and social distancing until we really get this thing under control. And I think that that's sort of the gloom and doom picture that some people sort of talk about.
We are out of time, but I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, but when Alan and I talk, one of the things that we talk about in our private phone conversations is how lucky we are to have you. So I thank you very much for being on the show being with us, and I look forward to our next conversation.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Fagan, thank you. Alan, thank you as always.
Thanks, Joe. You're terrific.
And to you. We'll do it again tomorrow. We'll be back with more Roundtable right after this.